Hello, everybody, and welcome to a new episode of The Week in Hand. On this episode of The Week in Hand, me and Joe sit down for a conversation with Dr. Samantha Masley and Romy Sherlock from Air Valley Psychology. We cover numerous different subjects, obviously including the elephant in the room at the moment, COVID-19, and people's mental health in regards to this, but a ton of other subjects, including child psychology, PTSD, etc., which honestly, we really think you're going to enjoy. Me and Joe really enjoyed it, and we're super stoked to put this one out. We hope you like it, and obviously, if you do like this, share this out to as many people as you can. It would be greatly appreciated. We hope you enjoy the conversation and take care of yourselves and peace. Bye-bye.
Okay, so we're recording. So as the first question I wanted to ask you guys, since obviously it's the elephant in the room at the moment is COVID-19, and because it seems to have affected the whole world. It's definitely affected me. It's affecting Joe because obviously he's a paramedic. But as for you, you guys, how is it affecting you? Are any of your clients on the front line or anything like that? Have you had people coming to you? I don't know which one of you wants to answer that question.
Well, shall I start first?
Yeah.
We think for psychologists, this is probably the calm before the storm, really. So, I mean, there are a few people that would come straight away, but typically we might see people just a little bit after. When things have really started to settle, that's not to say it's not creeping into our work yet, but it tends to be more people that we're working with, perhaps they know family members, things like that. But especially the people on the front line, more often than not, they're kind of taking a deep breath and are so immersed in it right now that they're just, I expect, getting on with it, doing the best that they can. And it might be just a little bit after when they get a chance to breathe and think, hey, this has affected us too. So, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think what we are probably both seeing a lot of is, you know, obviously as psychologists, we work a lot with people who have anxiety and depression and those kinds of difficulties anyway. And it's completely understandable that this whole situation has exacerbated that for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So I've certainly had clients coming back that had previously been sort of discharged and doing well. Clients who maybe were sort of coming up to discharge with, and then suddenly, actually, it's not the right time.
Yeah, I think it's so strange. Like I it's weird because just today, I was trying to set a podcast up today, and I'm not going to mention any names, but the person I messaged to see if they wanted to come on, who I considered a really like astute, you know, he seems super confident. He's a great artist and everything like that. I asked him to come on and he's just said, I'm sorry, no, which I really appreciate his honesty, but he's just said, no, honestly, I am not in a good place. I am stuck in my flat. I haven't seen anyone. He also said that he can't see his kid. He did have half custody of his kid, but he can't see his kid, which is another subject bringing up really. But it's weird how just tough people are actually finding it. I mean, I think I've struggled a little bit. I'm a very confident person and outgoing, so I haven't struggled loads, but it's still hard to deal with. You know, I think so.
I think it's changing people's lives dramatically. So yeah, families, you're either stuck in a very intense situation, or you're pulled apart. So you might not be living with a parent if you're a child, for example. Yeah. And if you had certain anxieties will have certainly gone up. So anxiety, things like OCD and contamination. So that's something that people have been getting in touch with a little bit more, because if you're already perhaps nervous around those kind of issues, it's been absolutely rammed in your face at the moment, how dangerous germs can be. And so, yeah, it depends. it's going to be affecting different people in different ways. And low mood, well, one of the things that's critical to helping people's mood can be what you're doing, where you're going, who you're spending time with, exercise, and our social networks, which often support people as well. They're being really put under strain. Some people are great with things like Zoom and social chat, but it's not for everybody.
Yeah,
I think it's fair to say as well, you know, that some people are actually living their best life that I've been talking to, who are saying, I'm really socially anxious and I absolutely love the fact that I don't have to go out of my comfort zone. I don't have to go and push myself at work and sort of go in kind of social situations and have to kind of wing it. I'm actually really happy being at home and sort of managing, you know, with the constraints that we've got. So I guess, you know, there's some kind of unexpected silver linings in there for people as well.
Yeah, there's always going to be two sides. Well, there always is maybe two or three sides to our story. But like, I get what you're saying there, that there's, even though it's been quite negative, just because of everything that's been taken away from everyone, really, there's a ton of positive things that have come out of it that you might not even know yet until it's all over. You know, I definitely feel like that. I've when it first started, Joe will attest to it, I was struggling quite a lot. And as time's gone on, I've been like, actually, I can do this now. I can do this. And I'm trying to enforce this. And I'm trying to put this habit in. And I'm trying to do this. And hopefully, by the time I'm allowed to do my normal, as a tattoo artist, I really don't know if that's going to be for a while yet. But when I'm allowed to resume normal service, I should be a better human, you know, hopefully. I don't know.
So when you first got into psychology, how did you get into it and what inspired you to get into that field for one? And obviously it's an immense scope, the field. So could you just expand on your sort of direction within psychology, or what interests you within psychology, just to get our listeners sort of on board and what you do.
Do you want to go first? It's a big question. Shall I go first? Yeah,
you go first. Yeah,
right. Well, for me, I think people have always just fascinated me. I just love being around people. I love talking to people. I could talk all day, every day. And I think it's partly that, really. That was one of the reasons why I got into it. I just found it really interesting and I followed my heart and I ended up here. In terms of the different things that I do with people, I work with both adults and children. So I work across the life. I think my main interest, I came from health initially, so I worked within physical health and actually palliative care. So I started my career right at the end of life, if that makes sense. And, I think there's a lot of wisdom to be had when you work in that field. You work with people that are at a point of reflection and they talk about the points of their life that they loved, and they also reflect on the parts of their life that maybe they didn't love so much. But that was a very intense area, an area that I worked in for quite a few years, but it's heavy. It's special, it's precious, it's wonderful, but it's quite heavy. And so now I work a lot with trauma. I work a lot with adults and I work with kids. And I suppose partly I brought some of that wisdom through. So as I'm coming back down across the lifespan, keeping the end of life stuff close, if that makes sense, to help me with the work now. So I think I can't remember all your questions, but.
Yeah, just cut in there, Sam, sorry, just while we're talking about that. So with the end of life, and you were saying that there was certain things that people would reflect on, was the themes within that, as in they would reflect on certain, but you know, different people would reflect on similar themes?
Well, I think it's the point where you really realise what matters. And sometimes life is so busy and so fast that we forget to breathe and take stock of what's really important to us. And maybe, you know, what we were saying about, for some people, this is a pause in their life and it's actually doing them a lot of good just to spend time with their families or spend time with themselves and just really understand what matters. Mm. So I think that's the general thing. When we're facing death, we really realise what's important about life. And so maybe we'll all come out of this a little bit wiser and a little bit more grateful for the things that we do have. And I think one of the things that I took from working with people at the end of life is the importance of really living, you know, each day the best we can. And yeah,
I feel like when I feel like that hit me when I lost my dad. I think when I lost my dad, I realized, oh, you know, I'm not immortal. Like I do have to die. You know, I knew it anyway, obviously, but I realized at that point that, oh, you know, I've got to pass at some point. It scared me to some degree as well, because then I realized every other person that I loved around me could go before me. And I don't know if I can climb those mountains, you know, like losing my dad was the first person close to me that I lost. It tore me apart, but then I knew I had to get to climb that mountain, touch the top and climb back down the other side. You know, then you have children. I've got a little girl and a little boy. And it's scary because it makes life just a little bit like, it puts you on edge because you realize that you're constantly, you know, like you could be broken within like a second, you know, like everything could be completely taken away from you. You hear so many horror stories about this, that and the other. I think when you get to end of life though, that's a different human, isn't it? Because that human has survived the whole life. They've got to a point where their body is old. It's slowly shutting down. You know, they've lived their life, and hopefully at that point, they've lived a life of fulfillment. You know, they've ticked boxes.
Just to stop you there, Lee, the end of life palliative care, they don't just deal with elderly people. They deal with people who are
right, okay.
That's the sort of ideology is, you've lived a full life and you're happy with your life and you've
got, right, yeah, so it's even worse,
family around your bed, but it's not, you're not just as a was you a end of life doctor, Sam, or are you an end of life nurse or palliative care nurse?
We're both clinical psychologists, actually, both me and Romy, and Romy also has had some experience working in end of life, but yeah, as you said, end of life is, we both worked in adult services, but that's everyone over 18. So it covers a very vast age span, really, and not everybody feels ready. not everyone.
Yeah, instantly gets even heavier, to be honest. You know, like, because if you think about what I was talking about, but then you know, like, if you're thinking about that, yeah, that's a lot heavier, isn't it? If you've got somebody who's nowhere near ready to go, but they know they're passing, it's like it's even worse. Mm. Yeah.
How did you get into the field then, Romy?
I'll be totally honest, I flipped a coin between two different degrees because I wanted to do something scientific but also something kind of involved with people. One of my friends from school was going to do psychology and I was like, oh, that sounds quite interesting. But having then kind of done my degree, I really sort of fell in love with the clinical side. So when you do sort of undergraduate degree in psychology, it just gives you a really broad sort of grounding, really, in psychological theory. It doesn't, and sort of research and things, but it doesn't train you to be a psychologist, to do the sort of individual specialisms. So it's quite a long training route. You then have to do some work experience and then a 3-year doctorate. So once I'd sort of set my heart on clinical psychology, I did kind of, you have to sort of get quite a bit of work experience because it's quite a competitive process to kind of get selected for the golden kind of chalice, isn't it, Sam? So you end up kind of odd jobbing here, there and everywhere, doing, you know, bits and bobs. But yeah, once I did my training, I I've always worked similar to Sam in sort of physical healthcare, and then kind of moved into sort of, I guess it's quite natural really, if you work with people with physical health problems, that there's often a lot of trauma involved as well. So we've both become really quite interested in kind of working with people who've had trauma experiences as well. And the last 7 or 8 years I've also kind of specialised in working with people with chronic pain. So, okay. A little bit different.
Yeah, ongoing pain issues.
Yeah.
So just to take it back, sorry Sam, as well, you were saying that you were dealing with children, your child psychology as well. How do you differentiate your practice with children and adults? How do you go about doing that? Because obviously, child psychology to me, a lay person in this, would be massively different than dealing with an adult, I presume.
Oh yes, it really is, and that's a fascinating question. You see, well, I don't know if this is probably just the vocal that goes out from this, but my room generally is set up for adults, and then I've got all the child stuff hidden. You can't tell, but literally my feet are on a sandpit as I'm talking to you. Full of like sand and toys. I've got boxes of things that flash and beep and Play-Doh hidden around the place. And it's much more experiential with children. You often come alongside them and play with them. And trauma work with children looks very, very different. It's more creative than trauma work with adults, because they've got all their little defences and just the way that they work things through is different. If you watch a child, they play things through and talk things through and act things through, and the work, psychology work, often reflects that. It's coming alongside a child and figuring out their way. So it's great fun. I find it incredibly energising. but the way it kind of creates in this room, just need to have space between the two, because after the child is like coated the place in sand, it's like, quick, hoover it all up.
Do you ever sort of, I think I know the answer to this question, but I'd like you to expand on it. Do you ever meet a child who's had a traumatic experience at a young age and think this is going to affect them for the rest of their life, no matter what input I have? Or are you optimistic that the input that you have can rectify and that child can go on and live a somewhat normal life?
That's a great question. That's not an easy answer, but I'll tell you what my thoughts are around that. That's a really good question. I don't think we ever forget what happens to us. The body and the mind are designed to not forget. It's like if you were ever in a trauma, let's say, I don't know, you were run off the road or you had a near-death experience, expecting your mind and body to forget that is just never going to happen. I mean, we would be really unsuccessful as species, wouldn't we? Imagine if we nearly die and we forget about it and then we go and do the same thing again. And we just wouldn't. So I think we all carry our pasts, and the mind tries to get wiser and wiser and wiser. I think when working with trauma, it's just teaching people the skills to come alongside that distress in a way that it doesn't negatively impact on them, or come alongside and help them to find ways to cope with it and to work with the feelings so that they get really good at it and it doesn't intrude anymore. Does that make sense?
How to deal with a situation, like you said, is learning how to find a way to fan the flame, to put a cold like towel on the actual feelings in a certain sense, isn't it? You know, like to be able to deal with it from a traumatic situation, you've got to learn how to deal with it in order to move forward, because it's gonna, like you said, it's gonna keep coming back up. But you know, like that situation is gonna keep coming back up in your life. But as far as a kid though, as a child, when, how young would you say a child would have to be for them to never forget a situation? You know, are we talking like 3, 2?
Oh, well, but that's also, this is fascinating. I'm sorry, I could talk for hours on this. It depends on the way that we remember things. Because as adults, we often remember things in pictures and in words. So So once a child has language, so when they're, you know, sort of, well, 3-4-ish, I'd say, something like that, they start to develop language. And by 6 or 7, they're going to be quite proficient in that and laying down most of their memories in that verbal, that yeah. verbal form with images. And before that, it's not that they don't remember. So we can, we might have bodily memories for things that happened before we've even spoken. And there's some fascinating work that would say that we can experience trauma from very, very, very young in life. But the way that we, the way that that memory is encoded is not going to be the same. So it might be in physiological responses or, yeah, it's just stored differently.
That's, I mean, there's wicked. Also, evidence coming out, isn't there, about intergenerational trauma that, say, for example, survivors of Auschwitz, that their children and grandchildren had kind of more markers of traumatic experiences despite not experiencing them themselves. So it's a super fascinating, complicated subject, isn't it?
Yeah. You get the excitement coming up 2 seconds and we're like, oh, fascinating area. One of my lectures way back while I was doing my doctorate, they were talking about how the brain responds even in the womb. So humans, we're designed to be constantly adapting to our environment. So if you have a baby who's in the tummy of a woman who's going through really difficult, stressful times, then there's a bit more cortisol in the blood. And they look at, it's fascinating, that infant is getting designed to come into a world ready. So again, our brains are being shaped by our experiences even before we're born, or from our parents, like Romy was saying. It's fascinating. Mm.
It's fascinating how much stress actually, too much stress can really, really mess with the human body, can't it? You know, like you said, even the female going through stress with a baby inside can create stress within the baby. You know, they talk about, you know, like people, like, I was listening to someone today, if you're trying to lose weight, etc., on something, you know, like the idea is that you've got to cut your stress down as well, because some people might be ticking all the boxes and still can't seem to lose weight. And one of the benefactors can be stress. And it's so strange how it just seems to pass through everything, you know, like being able to be calm, relaxed, is a key to a lot of things in life.
Yeah.
Just a quick one whilst you're on that subject, sorry. So if the baby in utero is got a lot of cortisol level within the mother, how does that affect them in life? Does that make them less susceptible to cortisol or more susceptible to cortisol? So are they lower in mood, or are they heightened personalities within, like, type A personalities?
Oh, all different areas there. But it's more that the brain's readiness. So the brain comes out ready for a particular environment, which will be really great. If they're coming out into a stressful environment, then it's good for them to be sort of alert and ready. And
yeah.
Maybe, you know, their responses might be particularly sensitive to things like sounds and noises, you know, a bit more jumpy kind of thing. But then we change constantly because the brain's, we're constantly getting feedback from our environment. So if they then come out into a world that's safe and they get lots of cuddles, then the brain's responding to that too. So it's almost like our brains can keep on changing. And we learn how to manage those physiological changes better or worse. So rather than seeing it as trying to not feel anxious or trying to not feel stress, that's utopic goal for most people. But the other option is to get really good at managing those things, having loads of skills, learning how to surf the feelings, getting really confident that even when it's really intense, that you've got the skills that you need to be able to resource it. So it's combination of loads of things.
Yeah, it's really cool how, like, you were talking about then, like, how you said about it before, and it's always something that's boggled my mind, is when you know being able to, because if you can't speak, you know, we all speak English, that's our primary language, and that's how I think, you know, I feel like that's how I think in my mind, you know, when I'm thinking about a situation and I'm not vocalizing it to anyone, I'm thinking in English. So like you alluded to before, a child can think through a situation, you know, but doesn't have the vocab, the language to that's such a hard thing for me to vocalize as well, to deal with that situation. I always wonder what a 1, a 2, sometimes even a 3-year-old thinks like. How can they think if they don't have a language to think in? It sounds really weird. I don't know.
You're right. It's fascinating, isn't it? And I guess we can't really remember. None of us can really remember what that's like. But it's going to be way more sensory. But then even adults, so when we come up, we've all got different ways of relating to these experiences depending upon how we experienced them when we were younger. So all of us have different relationships. So everybody could feel fear, you know, in the same way, but each person will have a unique association with it. So if fear was met with loads of support, lots of cuddles, soothe system well activated afterwards, you might feel it, but go, oh, it's all right, it's going to go in a minute. If your threat system when you were younger was activated and it just kept escalating and you were left on your own and it got more and more unbearable and the terror mounted, that's it. That person as an adult might feel a touch of that and go, oh, heck, you know. But our relationships so complex with these things.
Yeah. So, Romy, sorry, just to interject, with the current situation and obviously children being at home and not at school, what would parents be looking for with sort of anxiety levels and sort of deficits? Is there anything particular that parents should be keeping an eye out for?
Yeah, I think what I'm kind of seeing is that there's just such a huge variety of how children are responding to this. So Sam and I are parents of 7 children between us, so we've got a little bit of experience. kind of in our own children, but also in sort of children of clients and friends and family. I think there's, in one sense, I'm just sort of seeing that children are hugely resilient and adaptable, that they kind of just know that, okay, so this is where we're at now, we're in this weird situation and we're just getting on with it. I think, you know, for some kids, actually life's going to be a lot better because perhaps they've got a lot more kind of opportunity to have close relationship with their parents, which they might not normally have if obviously they're at school or parents work long hours. But I think there's a lot of fear as well, isn't there, in some kind of subsets of kids that, you know, they hear stuff on the news, don't they? They hear adults talking and they're like little sponges, aren't they? I think they soak up conversations and things that we don't always realize, and they know that, you know, we're scared, we are kind of all tolerating uncertainty, we just don't know, we can't answer their questions, can we, with any kind of conviction about when things will be different. So in terms of what to look out for, I guess it's really difficult because it's kind of my sense is not wanting to sort of pathologize as well at the moment and sort of have lots of children diagnosed with anxiety disorders and things. You know, because it's normal, isn't it? And it's really appropriate that we might be all feeling more anxious. And just sort of trying to not kind of leap on that and worry about it too much, but just provide, I think we're talking a lot about kind of that Maslow's hierarchy, aren't we, Sam? That kind of like bottom layer of, you know, can we just make sure all the basics are well met? Like
100%.
Are we safe? Have we got food? Have we got kind of caring and connection with people? And maybe we can't really work on any of that other stuff that's higher up at the moment because we are all in a position of kind of not being that safe. So it's okay maybe to just to just focus on the basics, the, you know, the cuddles and the sort of reassurance and the playtime.
I think as well, like when it hit me, you know, I got my son full time and my daughter half of the time, so like spending, when it hit me that I was like, oh right, okay, I'm going to be with them a lot, you know, a lot now anyway, as it is. at the very start, I chose not to hide that what it actually was that's actually happening. You know, I found her. There was a guy as a doctor, Peter Atiyah, when he did a podcast with his daughter, and his daughter asked him questions that she wanted to ask about the virus. I listened to that, and it was really informative to me. But because Dr. Atiyah kind of he vocalized it really well. So I took the kids out to the supermarket and I took a long way round and just put the podcast on in the car. So my daughter, who's just about to be 7, she could listen to it, because I really didn't want them. This is so never happened before. It's like unprecedented. It's never happened before to anyone really of any generation that's alive right now, you know? So I think hiding it would be a foolish thing to do. You've got to put all your keys on the table and tell them exactly what's going on with a lot of things with your kids anyway. But them struggling and seeing how kids are dealing with it, what you said before, Romy, like, they're so resilient. My kids have not really shown any real sign of being any different. You know, some days they might wind each other up a little bit more than the others, and it might get me a little bit more irate because I've got a lot more riding on it, haven't I? I've got a business, I've got like normal life, you know, I'm like, I want it to be back, you know, but the kids are like, I'm just chilling, you know, we're not going to school, okay, no worries, you know, and all that kind of stuff. I think kids are... they are so resilient, and it isn't till I become a parent that I realize just how resilient they are to certain situations. You know, like we said before, this has never happened before. So I think with everything, we're all going to know more about it when it's over. So when it's over, there might be another pandemic. but up until that point, we're going to be able to look back at the numbers, look back at the mental health decline, which you said right at the start, Sam. I think we're going to see that coming up. You're going to start to see people coming through into your practice, and that's when you're going to start to see it. Like now, it might just be trickling in. It's after the after effects of, like, you know, because I just, you know, I want to cuddle someone. I want to be able to go up to my friend and be like, hey, you know, I mean, me and Joe used to do jujitsu all the time. You know, I want to be able to do jujitsu. I want to be able to, it's human contact as well, you know, and that's completely been taken away from us. I'm single. I live on my own. I've got no one to cuddle up with apart from my kids, you know, and it is different. So I don't know. I think we're all going to, as positive as I may seem,
yeah, it's a very optimistic. Lee's always very optimistic. One of my best friends. But so we were seeing depression and anxiety rising within younger people, and we were seeing diagnosis of depression between sort of the ages of 14 and 20.
As you were speaking, it's that age group actually that I'm thinking about in particular, because we go through different phases of development. We meet at different milestones at different ages. So when we're younger, so younger children, it's all about play and exploring and learning how to do big body movements. And then they learn how to be a bit more social and how to do sort of things that are a bit finer. By the time we get to teens, that one of the pivotal parts of development there is about going, it's sort of getting out of the house, establishing independence, and whatever route young people take, whether they're going to college or uni or taking on apprenticeships or just kind of staying home but being out a bit more, it's a point of independence. And so this, I think it's affecting everybody in different ways, but that particular age range, I think, because it's clipping the wings and it's stopping them doing something that's quite very natural at that point in their lives. Although they are perhaps a wee bit more savvy with the technology. So younger people are natives to it now, aren't they? They grow up with it. Their fingers fly through technology. So hopefully they're navigating it in that way. But yeah, I think that must be tricky being a teenager. And
just to cut in there, Sam, sorry, because you mentioned technology. Do you, what's your thoughts, and you're both parents as well, so I presume you psychoanalyze your kids. What's your thoughts?
Only if they pay us.
What's your thoughts on social media and age groups within that? So children using social media, you think it's a good thing for the brain or not?
Oh, wow. Yeah. I don't know if you can get me started on social media, actually. It's something that I've got. It's a tricky area, isn't it? I don't know whether the brain... I think we all struggle with social media, don't we? It's one of those things, it's addictive, it's compulsive, it's hitting parts of the brain that we like to be hit. And every time you go on, there's a new thing. And it, you know, like shops in the olden days were designed to try and draw your eye. Well, you know, whatever they learn in shops about marketing and drawing people's attention, I mean, social media, it's like crack cocaine to the brain. It's like bang, 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 bang. So I think we all struggle with it. But there's great things about it as well, because it does bring people together. It does connect. It means that we can talk just now. And if you were somebody living all on your own, I mean, there's people out there with no one, perhaps even not even pets in their home, and 6 weeks with absolutely no physical contact. Well, that's we're not designed for that. Humans are designed to reach out, to connect, to live in packs. So there's good things about it, but do I think it's all good? Probably not. As a psychologist, I think that it can sometimes distract us from noticing some of the other elements in life that are better for our well-being, but are less, perhaps less in your face, better, and you have to work towards.
I don't know how old your kids are, but are you allowing them to use social media? Have you got a sort of age range which you think is acceptable for social media for children, or? Have you got any thoughts on that?
I'm quite young.
Yeah, I was too young, I think, but I don't even know what the you know, like with parenting, you kind of just deal with each stage as you get to it, and you know, like your bit, but you don't know the next bit. I don't even know what the is it 12 to have a Facebook account, or 14?
I think so. Yeah.
Yes, it's, and I think. I know not all, I certainly talk to lots of adults about kind of giving up social media, because it's really hard to get the perspective sometimes, isn't it? That it's a highlights reel, and it's easy for people to kind of do that compare and despair thing where they look at other people and be like, their life's brilliant and mine's terrible, or I'm rubbish. And I think kids find that even harder as well. It's like it's a sort of glossy facade, isn't it, of other people's lives. So I don't know, I think it's really hard to have a clear cut, you know. It's definitely not demonizing social media, because it's, again, it's, it'd probably be harmful, wouldn't it, for teenagers not to be allowed to use it.
They've got to be able to connect in with their peers, and it's all about comparison. And if you're the only person in the class that can't, then maybe you'll get left behind in a new way. But yeah, I think we're both lucky enough, just that our kids are at an age where we haven't yet had to navigate that.
I think I constantly think that, you know, we can't protect children from so many things, but what we can do is we can equip them with the skills to manage it. So we can warn them about, you know, these kinds of things, can't we? And we can tell them about how social media can feel really addictive, or sometimes it can feel wonderful and sometimes it can feel awful. And, you know, I guess the difficulty with teenagers, maybe, and adults, is that when there's things like bullying going on, that there is no break from it. There's no going home for the weekend and thinking, I'm away from people from school, because it's kind of ever present. So there's lots of minefields, aren't there? But I guess.
Yeah, I like the idea of that as well. I did, I've heard someone allude to that before, but in like nutritional sense as well, like, you know, the idea of teaching them that something is bad for them, you know, or a way of handling it, and letting them make the decision themselves, you know. They're going to grow up to be adults eventually. We all were kids. So equipping them with the idea of, like, you know, sugar in a large quantity is not good for you, drinking your calories is not good for you, all this kind of stuff, you know, telling them that this is healthy and this is unhealthy, as opposed to, like, with social media as well, you know, too much, you can get addicted to social media to a point where you're constantly looking at that platform for a feel good, for your dopamine hits and things like that. And I think that's a, if you can teach them, you know, like, you know, you could teach your children that smoking is bad, but a lot of the times when, you know, when I was at school, I you know, you see your friend smoking and we tried a cigarette, but I don't smoke, you know, and it's the idea of like, you're teaching them, you get taught that it's wrong and you know it's wrong, but you can make your own decisions because that's what's going to happen in the end up anyway.
Yeah, I suppose humans as well, we're a special species in the fact that we're designed so that wherever our brains or minds go, our bodies can follow quite quickly, even if it's not happening to us. So we see this in all different ways, but particularly in social media. So, you know, you might be in a really good place with your body, on a bit of a high, body's a bit buzzing, thinking about good things, and then suddenly you can scream, you can look through a feed and get hit by something that's quite scary or shocking, and you've not necessarily mentally prepared for it. It just pops up, and it could be phrasing, oh, look, helpful new way to identify cancer, and suddenly your body's like, boom, and you know, the body catches it, and it takes us a while to re-regulate after something like that. So I think a lot of the ways that we use technology, it's the fact that the body can respond quite quickly and be instantly transported from a place where it's happy and content into a fear state. And then we might have to work quite hard to get back to that, which I suppose is also a bit of a problem with potentially working from home. So yeah. Many people have had this separation between their work and their personal life, you know, their bedroom and their living room were relaxation places. And now I guess people are bringing potentially stressful, tricky things into their home environment, and it might be harder for people to turn off from work, especially if they've been homeschooling and working, and you know, so then they feel like they need to do a bit of work into the evening, and it might be really hard to get that proper rest space that the body.
You know, like we were saying before, though, you know, we could we could allude to this being a real problem when it comes to it. Like I said before, we're not going to know until it actually all subsides. We could just go back to normal, you know. There is a good chance that could happen. Obviously, there is going to be. That's me being optimistic again. But we just don't know. There could come a point where it all just slowly, you know, they ease lockdown, and eventually people are just like, ah, we carry on as normal to a certain degree, you know. Anyway, what I was going to say though is we're talking about kids and social media, but what about kids and tablets? You know, like. You know, like screen time in terms of tablets. I mean, my kid, my little girl is going on 7, and my little boy is going on 4, and they will have screen time, but it's, you know, to a certain degree, it's weird because when I first started, I was super militant with it. You know, I was like, no, you know, you can only have it for an hour, so you can have 2 half hours or an hour, but that's it once it's done. And then you see them playing on it and things like that, and you're like, right, that's, I've got it right. That I'm moralistically, I've made a right decision as a parent there. But you end up getting things done in the house. You're doing this, that, and the other. Before you know it, they've been on it for way longer than they should have done, and you start to chastise yourself. How do you feel about that?
Oh well,
sound too familiar.
It's very familiar. It's it's hard, isn't it? And I think especially just right now, we all have to be as kind as we possibly can to ourselves, because this is really intense. And I think we're very good at putting lots of pressure on ourselves in general. And life can get really busy, and we can do lots of comparisons. We see all over social media, everyone else is doing dirty, 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 dirty. And it makes us feel bad. And we can push ourselves to keep trying harder and harder and harder. And it's a lot of pressure. So sometimes I think we all just have to take a deep breath and say, oh, we're doing the best. It might not be perfect, but we're doing the best and we're getting through. And generally, I think that's what we're all trying to do at the moment. Just muddle through.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the evidence suggests as well that it's not necessarily about the screens, is it? It's about what children then lack because they're on the screens all the time, or because they're being babysat by the screens all the time. So if you're, you know, on a screen all day, then you don't have opportunities to interact with your siblings or your parents or your friends, or to play games or to move your body. So it's, you know, it's same with everything, isn't it? Moderation is key.
Yeah. I think it's easy for us to, as a generation, to be like, oh, you know, and panic about that. And then you think about the generation before and how, like, say, my parents had to deal with it. We had PlayStations, you know, and we had the N64 and all this. And it was just like, but we had a control and we were staring at the screen. But now, because we've got these touch screens, and we seem to panic and think that this is a new thing that's going to destroy our children, and we're not going to have any intelligent kid people anymore. But I really don't think, to be honest, that's going to be the case, because if you're in a system with your parents that actually do tick the boxes beforehand, you know, like, are you taking them out in fresh air? Are they getting vitamin D? Are they moving their body? Are they getting the heart rate up? Do they have other hobbies that aren't on a tablet? But then not only that, they're learning things, aren't they? You know, I remember the first time Felix, my little boy, he kind of touched the screen and made something bigger, you know, and I was like, no way, you know. And then you kind of think to yourself, should he know that? Yeah, he should. Of course you should know that. You should relax a little bit, because like you said, you can cause yourself, parental anxiety is real. And I remember being told that when I was struggling with that kind of thing, that when I got told that, it felt like there was a weight off my shoulders, you know, like, it's fine. You're just worried. It's okay to be worried about your parenting or how this, that, and the other, you know?
There's plenty of kids that, you know, sadly would not know which way to turn a page in a book.
Yeah.
You know? So actually it's okay, isn't it? If children have a mixture of different things to spend their time on, but with some adult interaction as well.
Yeah. I think it's, sorry, just on the last bit on that. I think as a parent, you can actually see, you know what I mean? If you're accountable to yourself, you can see if they've, you know, like, I'll know myself, you know, I can look up and be like, right, listen, put them down now. You've been on them too long. I need you in the room. You know what I mean? Because even though they're in the room, they're not in the room, you know? And I think that's with an adult as well. You know, you can have an adult on a phone and they can be, you know, they either got their head down. I remember the first time I went out and I saw a couple on a date. This is quite a few years ago now, but it took me back and I was like, no way. They're on a date, but they're both looking at their phone. I mean, we don't know the whole story there. But then I remember, like, years later, I found myself in that same situation. I was just, like, looking down at my phone. I think we're all a bit guilty of things like that.
It wasn't a great date, Lee. Yeah. That's funny. So I was, I've been just looking into just to change subject completely here. I've been looking into the domestic abuse statistics in the last sort of lockdown over the last 4 to 6 weeks, and they seem to have elevated. And when I tried to come to understand it, I just quickly realized that I didn't understand this, and that I thought there was a possibility of it sort of childhood abuse feeding through and then that creating an adult that was then an abuser as such. But the research doesn't seem to suggest that. The research suggests that most abusers don't come from you know, an abusive background. I don't know if you two have done any you know, research around this area or have any insights on this, but and obviously we've got the male dominant abuser as well, so we see a difference within the sexes in forms of abuse. I was just wondering if you could elaborate on this area, because I'm trying to get a better understanding of it and why it comes about.
I think my understanding echoes yours, Joe, that there's definitely not a really clear link between people who've experienced abuse themselves then going on to be perpetrators of abuse. But what we do see is that, I guess it's quite well documented, isn't it, that in pregnancy, for example, that women are more vulnerable to domestic violence. I guess it's in times of change and in times of stress. So that's what it got me thinking about, because obviously we're reading in the media, aren't we, that there's like 700% increase in calls to kind of domestic violence helplines and sort of really, really sad statistics like that. And I guess it's one of the ways that strain shows in people's relationships, and when they can't escape as well. There's no, you know, depending on your circumstances at the moment, there's not necessarily any, you know, going out to work or you know, any escape, is there, from the rising tension in a relationship. So it's not surprising, really, sadly.
Many people might have already been in abusive relationships, you know, before this happened, but they might have had ways of living with it that, you know, ways that made it a little bit better for them. So they might have been, you know, popping out and seeing friends or going to the gym on an evening or, you know, those kind of things. And it might be that some of their coping strategies, some of the things that made it feel a bit safer have gone away. So it's now much more intense and potentially dangerous. Under pressure and stress, you know, the things could be escalating in people's homes. If they're in that kind of relationship, it's quite worrying, really.
Yeah. It's been one of the sort of darker statistics of this whole pandemic. The male on female violence, the murder rate of domestic abuse has gone up also. Mm. But it, from what I can read and have read around, it does happen in times of crisis, and it's just that added stress that seems to just push it over the edge just a little bit. Mm. But I was also thinking along the lines of sort of how would we go about rectifying this problem, or how would other people recognise if they were in an abusive relationship? Because from what I can read is that some people don't even recognise that they are actually in an abusive relationship. Mm-hmm. They don't know it, and the abuser actually also becomes the carer, so they become sort of a paradoxical person. So I was just sort of wanting to ask a question about, like, how do you recognise certain things in you? I know you're not going to specifically tell me certain clients, and obviously I wouldn't want you to do that, but how do you go about sort of coaxing people to tell you about their sort of relationships and things that have gone wrong in their lives?
It's mainly the opposite way around, really. It's usually when people have already come to a decision or they choose to bring it to talk about it, because this is one way of looking at it. There's many different ways, but I guess for some people, if they don't necessarily believe that they've got the skills and the resources to do something about it, the mind can sometimes go, well, I'm not going to really highlight this to you because it's going to be more distressing for you if I tell you this is a problem and you feel stuck. You see, so sometimes I think that the mind kind of makes its own decision for the person, if that makes sense, and goes, your resources are this much and the problem's this much. I'm going to wait until those two things are a little bit closer, or I'm going to wait until you really can't bear it anymore, and then I'm going to. So usually people can have been in abusive relationships for a time, and they might just reach a certain point where they think, right, you know, I'm ready now. And I think it's when people make that choice that there's people there to say, right, let's help you.
It's a good point as well about, you know, people not recognising what's abuse, because we would all recognise, you know, physical abuse probably as unacceptable or something that doesn't happen to everybody. But it's the more kind of like coercive control and sort of kind of emotional abuse, I think, sometimes that people can mix up as, you know, somebody caring for them, or kind of, there's a fine line between care and control, isn't there? So I think sometimes people, I guess, in the course of kind of having conversations in therapy, can start to recognize, you know, where something doesn't quite feel right, or it feels, I don't know, there's a sense that it's not helping them live the kind of life that they want to.
Mm. Yeah, you spot vulnerabilities within your patients. Have you ever had to act on certain things with your specific patients of vulnerabilities have you ever had to sort of think, I need to sort of maybe call the police or get somebody else involved and maybe go above and beyond patient confidentiality? Have you ever had to, you know, incite any of that?
For sure. I mean, I don't think anybody that works kind of in our field would ever be able to kind of have a career without having to break confidentiality in, you know, to keep somebody safe. So, you know, I'm sure Sam has too, certainly had, you know, child safeguarding issues, domestic abuse, and obviously risk of self-harm as well.
Yeah, because self-harm, again, obviously, just looping back to mental health issues there, self-harm is obviously a physical sign of somebody struggling with mental health. But some of the patients which I have come into contact with say that actual harm makes them feel alive and makes them sort of more grounded, and that's why they do it. I don't know, obviously, your thoughts on this, but how would you go about coaxing somebody to make them understand that they shouldn't be actually hurting themselves, and that there is other ways to deal with things like that?
Another big area. Okay.
Sorry, it's got a little bit deep.
They're really broad areas. I like it. Well, I guess one of the ways that we would work with that is recognize the function, because people usually do something. There's a reason. There's something going on there. So whether it is being self-harm is kind of pulling them out of the dissociative state, or just it might be less pain than the emotional pain they're in. So they're moving an emotional pain into a physical pain, one which they have control over. They can intensify it, or they can. So it's trying to figure out what it is that they're getting from the self-harm. And then getting creative with people and thinking, well, can we lessen the pain so that you don't need the self-harm to manage it? Can we do that? So we might use therapeutic techniques. Need to get my teeth in. Techniques to help with that. But the other thing might be to look at other strategies that have got intensity or distraction that are perhaps less damaging to the body. So, you know, I don't really want to give too many techniques on air, because people might be like, oh, can I go and have a go with that? And I think these kind of techniques as professionals, there are things that we can kind of move, you know, move one type of more dangerous type of self-harm into something a bit safer. So you kind of work around in different ways, really, figuring out.
Yeah. I think when we sort of work with people with these kinds of difficulties, Sam and I both do a lot of work coming from a sort of compassion focused approach as well. So kind of recognizing if it's a way of punishing yourself, or if someone's got kind of real core beliefs that they're worthless, we might actually be trying to think about how they can develop those soothing strategies and be a bit more kind and caring for themselves as well, so that the self-harm doesn't feel like the most obvious kind of first step, really, to kind of helping the pain.
Yeah. What's your thoughts on pharmacological treatments for anxiety and depression? Do you have any specific for's or against, or age limits? Or because I'm seeing in my practice, I'm seeing a lot more younger people on antidepressants. Well, it seems that from an anecdotal point of view, it seems like that. I don't know if you have anything to suggest on that.
I know a lot of people as well. It seems to be, it keeps going for higher and higher than that, people that I know that are on antidepressants to a certain degree. So, yeah.
Well, that's a talk point in itself. The reason why perhaps so many people are needing help around with medications right now. So mental health in general is a really problematic field for many, many, many people. So that's a discussion point in itself. What's going on? Well, how have we got to this point where it's such a problem? But what was the other point where you asked, what are our thoughts around that?
Yeah, so obviously, if you want to elaborate on why you think we've got to this point as a societal or epidemiological point that, yeah, go ahead, riff on that. But also the fact that younger and younger people seem to be putting on antidepressants, and whether you think that's right or wrong, because obviously the brain's still developing through our teens and into our early 20s. So I'm not sure your points of view on this. So I'd just like to hear what you've got to say.
I think one probably important point is that, you know, we don't prescribe as psychologists. So it's sort of outside of our area of expertise in terms of, you know, what the evidence base would say. And but that's not to say that I'm sure we don't have thoughts on that. I think that, you know, mental health services, including children's mental health services and adolescents, have been absolutely decimated in the last, you know, 10 years. So I guess GPs, often the only option they really have is to reach for a prescription pad. And, you know, even though we know that everything says that, you know, we should be looking at it, you know, from a sort of holistic model and not just a kind of biological one, that we don't always have the option to do that.
It's weird. I think we're living in a world where it just gets further and further to the point where we move further and further away from nature. Our feet never touch, you know, earth anymore, you know, anything like that. We spend so much time being busy, which hopefully this will force people to not be busy, and like find that love of being outside. But not only that, it's a bit too busy to the point where we can't actually do physical activity, you know, where social media is coming in and we don't have that closeness, like full circle what you were talking about before, where your head's down on your phone all the time. You're not flourishing those relationships that you could do. So yeah, it's easier to see the dark than it is to see the light. There's so many, as well with nutrition as well, there's so many things that you can point towards first before you actually prescribe a drug. But like you say, it's hard to say that to a human. Be like, well, have you done this? Have you done this? Do you do this? And have you done this before? You know, because 9 times out of 10, they're going to want an answer straight away. You know, I feel this way. What can you do to help me? You know, and I think that's where the pressure comes in from doctors, et cetera, to prescribe and just be like, right, okay, we're going to put you on these. And as soon as you become dependent on something to feel good, oh God, how do you get back out of that? You know, without someone say, you know, if somebody comes to you and say, you know, like, what food are you eating? You know, like, are you eating enough food? You know what I mean? Because that's a problem. If you're not eating enough food, then, you know, you are going to feel down, or, you know, or are you moving and all this kind of stuff? It's massive. It's a massive thing to bring up to someone who is feeling, because I've spoke to so many people that are in that situation, and I can try my hardest to like advise them what I do to make myself feel in a good place and to feel happy. But you can be flogging a dead horse 9 times out of 10, and it must be frustrating for a doctor or people like yourself to actually have to deal with that and be like, right, listen, you know, you're not getting, I don't know. It's so hard. It's such a dodgy situation.
I think you're elaborating on something there, Lee, and that's the fact of, like, with your profession, obviously you talk to you with the colleagues and get feedback from your other colleagues, but do you obviously take on board the things that people are saying, and do you take them home? And also, do you have we as paramedics have a burnout, we call it burnout, where you just can't give any more empathy or any more compassion or whatever the things that we need to be giving. I presume that exists in your field. Have you experienced that?
100%. Honestly, so much. We're like a more exaggerated version of a hairdresser. It sounds really ridiculous because, you know, like everybody seems to like spill their beans to a hairdresser, but if you're with a tattoo artist, they it's more personal. I'm touching you, and not in a, you know, but like I'm touching you. You're with me for like hours as well.
There's something very intimate about that, you know.
100%, 100%. And they tell you more, and they're more open about this, that, and the other. And it's shocking how many people aren't ticking the boxes, and you can understand it so clear why people aren't well, and they don't feel happy, you know, and they're not in a good place. And Yeah, I do get a lot of people. I said this to you as well, Joe, the other day. You know, it's so weird, you know. I was so happy. I was having such a good day. I've been out with my son. You know, I'd worked out. Everything's going good. And then I messaged you and you were like, yeah, it's all right. It was a tough night last night. And I forgot that you'd work nights and you're a paramedic. And the amount of times that you come across things and you must see things. How do you deal with that? How do you psychologically deal with that? You know, like...
I'm not sure if I deal with it right, to be honest. Because obviously, Sam and Romy, you must have the same thing. It's departmentalization, isn't it, really? It's not trying not to take things home or trying to deal with them in the correct manner. And I'm sure this must have happened to you too as well, but you have certain patients that keep creeping back into you, keep creeping back, and you're just thinking, you know, why is that still bothering me, still bothering me? And it's that feedback and that sort of, it's a negative feedback can put you in certain places. I mean, it only takes, you know, me to think about certain jobs and I'm back there with in that scenario. So I'm not sure there's obviously techniques to deal with things, but I think I'd like to ask Sam and Romy that is, does that happen to you within your practice? And do you have a sort of, can you burn out in your field? Can you get to the point where you think, I'm not clinically doing what I should be doing for these patients because I'm too emotionally drained or, you know, too invested in this person or too connected to them, you know? Because obviously, I presume you don't see anybody that you actually know or your friends or family and things like that. So, you know, have you ever got too close to a patient and invested emotionally, too much emotionally? And secondly, is there a burnout period or is it a real thing within your profession?
Good questions.
Yeah. I think we're really lucky as a profession that we, as part of our ongoing registration and our kind of professional development, we have to have clinical supervision on a monthly basis. So we have to spend time reflecting and talking about our cases and thinking about how they've affected us, which is huge. Sam and I do that for each other, so that's part of our partnership. So yeah, but I mean, for sure, and I think you know, certainly personally for me, that was part of working in independent practice now is about having the autonomy to work in a way that feels manageable. So, you know, we can create our own caseloads and our own days. And, you know, when you work with trauma and complex trauma, a lot of the time we, you know, might try and space our workload out so that people with particularly difficult problems, you're not sort of getting that vicarious trauma after vicarious trauma. But yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think there's plenty of people in our profession that have left or, you know, decided to do things differently because it's tough. But, you know, I think being a paramedic's tough, working in A&E's tough, you know, loads of jobs are tough, aren't they, psychologically? Yeah. And we're lucky because we get trained to do that and we've got really robust systems in place to help us.
Yeah,
but there's also something very meaningful about it as well, and that's important to me. I didn't, when you asked the first question at the beginning, one of the reasons it's meaningful being a psychologist, it's meaningful when you've got that personal connection with people. It's what humans are all about. So whether you're making that connection while you're being a tattoo artist or a paramedic or a psychologist or a teacher or a social worker, it's about meaningful, doing something that you feel matters, and so it gives back in that way as well. And there's nothing wrong with feeling. So there's nothing wrong with remembering clients and having you know, a physiological response, whether that be concern or anything like that. That's a sadness if they've died, for example. I don't see that as a problem, but it's making sure that you've got good ways of re-regulating your body again. And I think that that's something as a society, when we think about how mental health has become more and more problematic, and we've seen it at a younger and younger age, maybe we're not teaching each other, and maybe we're not being taught while we're younger how to re-regulate the body. And I loved what you were saying there, Lee, about, you know, being able to spend time outside and eat well and socialize and hug each other. This is, I'm sorry, I'm sounding very kind of hippie with this, but all of these things are quite, they're important for the human body. Mm-hmm. And maybe we forget that a little bit, and maybe that's why there's a bit more challenge at the moment.
Yeah, I think because you felt like you had to put that tag on the end there, and I think that's part of the stigma that comes with it, is because people feel like it's a bit woohoo and a bit you know, like you said, spiritual to say that. It's not, you know, like I try and strip life down sometimes to see just how simple it is. And if you really strip life down, you take all the concrete houses that we're in, the cars that we're driving around in, the trainers that are on our feet, and the clothes that are on our body. What's real is human interaction, is feeling the elements, is eating good food. It's all important. If you not tick all them boxes, you are not going to be living a human. You're not going to be a human living an optimal life. Like, you're not. And it, you can see, people can see it in whichever woohoo way they want to, but they're the ones that will go down the wrong path, and they're the ones that will make the wrong, you know, the incorrect decisions. I think there is a stigma behind it, you know, like you're saying, and if that's in place, then people aren't going to tick them boxes. They're not going to, and that's where you're going to start to see the problems. And when you suggest that to them, you know, it might take them some time to eventually start doing that. I'm going to go on a walk. I'm going to go and climb a mountain, you know, or I'm going to go and do something that, you know, my people that I know that I've done something. A great example was my friend, who I took, 1 year I went, then the next year I went on this summer solstice walk up Mount Snowdon, and we'd set off at, we'd stay up all night, and then we set off at 4 with a large group of people. It was about 1 o'clock, and we'd get to the top for about 4, and then we'd wait for the sun to rise. And I went up with my friend just as he was about to become, he found out he was going to be a dad. And he was just full of emotion at the top, and he would never have done anything like that. He was somebody who'd go out, he would go out clubbing all night, taking drugs, doing this, that, and the other. And that's completely changed him. And I think when you've only got to see a few of those things, you've only got to put your mind in front, you know, your human body in front of a few of those things to be like, oh, that's what it's about. This is what it's about. What am I doing? Why am I bothering about whether this is doing this, or, you know, like, this is happening here, you know, like, I don't know. People put too much premise on things that just don't matter, and that's where things go wrong.
I totally agree with you about all of that, but I suppose it'd be a little bit remiss not to, just going back to Joe's point about, you know, that we all have a limit, don't we? And if you work as a paramedic and you see trauma after trauma after trauma, and you don't get time off, and your shifts get changed, and you don't have much control, and maybe you work with someone who's difficult, or, and your kind of resources get stripped, then it's also okay, isn't it, to, yeah, people do have lasting effects of trauma. And I guess that's why we're here, isn't it, that sometimes people need more than getting the basics well met.
Yeah. Sorry, just to, exactly, Romy. Obviously, I'm aware of the time constraints and stuff. So there is certain things being in place for people with PTSD, such as cognitive behavior therapy, and I believe there's a light therapy now, as well as pharmacological treatment. Have you ever referred people to this light therapy, or any new therapies that we might want to be aware of that suggest to us? Or
we're both the light therapy that you're referring to is called eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, but it's known as EMDR. Sam and I are both trained in that model, and it's something that we use as first line treatment for people with PTSD. It's in the NICE guidance. It's kind of one of the gold standard treatments alongside cognitive behavior therapy.
How does it work? Sorry.
Yeah, how does it work? Yeah. You don't have to say too much, you know, but
8 years of research and study.
It's I think you kind of have to suspend disbelief a little bit, really, but I suppose in a nutshell, it's how I would describe it to people is, I guess when you've had something traumatic happen, we don't always process that memory in the same way that we would a kind of non-traumatic memory, and it gets a bit stuck. We know that when people dream and they have rapid eye movement, that seems to be the time that we file memories away, so that they're kind of in the right place and they're kind of time dated, and all that knowledge is kind of stored together. So using EMDR is a bit like having a foot in the present and a foot in the past. So you get somebody in a really controlled way to think about the difficult thing that happened, and simultaneously ask them to follow the light with their eyes. Or you can use bilateral sounds, so sounds in each ear, or you can use tapping. And something about that process seems to help people kind of tax their working memory and put that memory away. So like Sam was saying earlier, we never forget things that have happened to us, but I'll usually say to people, it sort of takes the slap in the face away from it. So it's something you can remember, you can call up and retrieve, you can remember it, but without all the kind of overwhelming emotional and physical sensations that go with it.
Wow, that's amazingly interesting.
Mm. Used a lot with paramedics, actually, Joe.
Various members of the health service, because I guess they see things, don't they? Especially now, they're going to be seeing a lot of things that are going to make them feel quite powerless at times. So
yeah. So you've gone from public practice to private practice, I'm guessing, and was that due to the time restraints and everything that was going on in public practice, or is it just a is it for other reasons, or can you just elaborate on why you've made the move?
Well, for me, it was just about work-life balance. I was working in the health service. I was working with physical health and people nearing the end of life. And incredibly meaningful and wonderful service. And I look back with lots of fondness. You know, it's a really fond memory of being part of a big team and working alongside others, you know, for that kind of common good. It was really wonderful experience. But now I have I've got a big family, and I've just got a little bit more flexibility. I can get my children to school on a morning, and it's very important being able to control, you know, what we were saying about if you work very intensively with difficulty after difficulty after difficulty, the body really feels that. And it's important as a psychologist to have plenty of space, plenty of room, have time to be able to make sense of things yourself, get the good supervision, go on the training that you want to be able to go on to keep your skills up to date. And I guess in private practice, for me, it just gives me enough room for all of that. I love doing yoga. This sounds silly, but I go to yoga classes at lunchtime, and that again is part of my well-being and things I do. So
which yoga studio do you use? Give him a shout out.
Well, I go to a guy called Mark Thomas who I absolutely love, and he's got his mind body stuff all linked up, and I love it.
Yeah, I would say being self with myself as well. It took me a while to figure it out, but then I got to a point where, yeah, like I will only work for a certain period of the day. I have other hobbies. I need to tick other boxes, and it's all really important. Spend time with the kids. You know, if you can do it, do it. And I think even you've seen that at times, Joe. You've been like, oh, you can do this and you can do that. Yeah, I realized that after a certain period of time, you know, that's really important if I can do that, because, you know, I think people can work too much, you know. I think it's definitely something that's true. And I noticed that with myself, you know, you work, oh, keep working, we get all the money. well, it's not really important, is it? It's not really important. What's important is, you know, having other avenues to do things and test your body with and mind, you know, while she still can and all that kind of stuff. Sorry, it's late and I'm jabbing on at you here.
Yeah. So last question, obviously, what sort of areas are you looking to study in? Is there certain areas that you want your career to go towards? Or do you feel like it's more of just recapping what you've learned already? Because you've obviously spent a lot of time, you know, studying psychology. So is there certain areas which you want to promote more, such as the light therapy, or are you happy within your practice at the moment?
Good question. Yeah, I think we both specialise in trauma and this EMDR therapy. So yeah, it's kind of getting that message out there, I think, that, I don't know, it's a bit like if you're walking around with a stone in your shoe, you don't have to walk around with it, you know, you can stop and take it out. And for me, I think, you know, my area of kind of real interest is working with people with pain. So, and often that overlaps with kind of trauma as well. So, yeah, just that's my thing that I'll continue to do. But I think, yeah, we kind of work quite broadly, really, with lots of different people. I don't think we'll ever stop wanting to learn and study. No. I think it's kind of part of our kind of core, isn't it, Sam? Yeah. We actually have to encourage one another not to do things sometimes. Yeah.
It's funny, we'll both be signing up to loads of different training events now. It's like, have you seen this? There's a new speaker looking at pain in the body. Or have you seen this one? Look, there's new ways of using EMDR. We're constantly, and that's, we're just constantly looking to expand our own knowledge base.
And I love it. You can see so much passion in you guys. And I think that's it shows exactly why you do what you do. You see passion in something like that. It's wicked.
Yeah. Thank you very much for your time, guys.
Thank you. It's good to meet you.
Yeah, we'll let you go and enjoy your families if you can get a chance, okay?
Yeah, it's been really good to speak to you, honestly. You both super lovely, so it's been really nice to spend time with you.
Yeah, no, good. Stay in touch.
Yeah, we'll do.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye.